It was 2007, and Manny Howard was at a crossroads. He was a magazine writer reluctant to take on assignments because he was producing a documentary about the war in Afghanistan, but he was uninspired by that film project. And then an editor from New York Magazine proposed an assignment he couldn't turn down: start a farm in his backyard in Brooklyn, live for a month exclusively off what he could produce, and write a story about it. As he reveals, being a farmer is not for the squeamish, and it's not so easy to raise all the protein necessary to sustain yourself, especially when you also have to contend with acts of God. His article, which was both harrowing and hilarious, was not only a big hit, it won a James Beard Award, also got Mr. Howard a book deal, and the result is My Empire of Dirt, a cautionary tale, which is published by Scribner. I'm very pleased that it brings Manny Howard to our show. Hi.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Had you ever grown anything before you took on this assignment?
I think like many New Yorkers, I'd grown tomatoes and basil on my windowsill, but that's probably the extent of it.
Well, you say that you wanted to stop being a journalist and move on to other things.
Anything else, yeah, at the time.
Why? What had you been writing?
It's hardly a tough gig, but I wrote a lot of travel and food stories.
So you've been writing about food, but more like celebrity chefs than growing stuff in your backyard.
Restaurant coverage, recipes, you know, personal essays, that sort of thing.
The editors at New York Magazine chose you for the Locavore Farmer piece because they saw it as the ultimate Manny Howard story.
That's right.
So what did they think was the ultimate Manny Howard story?
Self-jeopardizing behavior, myopic, you know, obsessive core, I think, and the willingness to take on a job that would last 7 months or so.
So this had to sustain you for all that time.
Well, actually, the 7 months was the preparation period. The backyard really was backyard only in name. It was primarily lead poisoned clay. Mm-hmm. And so there was, after I'd said yes, and even as I said yes, I understood that there would be a fair amount of renovation to do before any food would be, you know, acceptable.
You had to dig up pretty much all the soil and replace it with new soil.
That's right. I dug a...
Were you composting?
Well,
because that's the best way to create your own soil.
Yes, yes. But I was working on a timeline, a magazine timeline, as I started, which was clearly, you know, 7 months. So we compost now, and we certainly composted a lot of waste as more and more animals came to the backyard, more than you can actually compost.
Because you weren't just growing things; you were bringing in animals, and we'll get to that in a moment.
That's right.
This grew out of your editor's reaction to the locavore movement.
Yeah, I think this was intended as a thumb in the eye to locavores.
So they let's get Manny Howard, and he'll make fun of all of this stuff, organic gardening and the locavore movement and all of that.
Yeah, I think there was an element of that.
Did they pick the right guy?
I thought so at that time, but it wasn't long before it was clearly I was the worst possible candidate. The idea of a magazine story completely disappeared from my day, and it became turning this dead piece of earth, this you know, wasteland, into something productive. And because I was where I was at, the crossroads that I was at, this inner voice said, "You're not going to fail at this too." After having felt like I had failed at things, and you know, to some lesser or greater extent, I had.
Well, your wife had a steady job, but
that's right. Yes.
You didn't have a steady job.
No, and have not been, you know, honestly employed since I was an editor at Gourmet some years ago.
And we don't even have Gourmet to kick around
anymore.
That's right. But Gourmet would have promoted locavore. I know Ruth Reichel used to be a regular on our show. We talked a lot about organic farming, but even more about local farming, which she felt was more important to support. Mm. There had been a couple of books that had come out. There was an article in The New Yorker, and this was a kind of intended as a kind of reaction to it all. Were you going to puncture the balloon of locavore?
There was this sense that as you went to a green market and you watched all these people with their string bag and their 75-mile radius map of New York City and their questioning of the local merchants about whether or not this fell within their understanding of locavorism, that there was this that there was this political importance that had been applied to locavorism. That
a self-righteousness, are you suggesting?
Well, self-righteousness is one aspect, but I think there really is a political that their purchasing decisions, I won't sink into they, us and them, the purchasing decisions of locavores were more informed, were somehow better than purchasing decisions that were being made. And I wanted to make the point that they're still purchasing decisions, that they're not political acts, and that there's a difference between knowing the farmer and being the farmer, as much as green markets help local farmers.
Although locavores will also tell you that part of their concern is about their carbon footprint, because the local food is grown locally. You're getting it fresher than you would if it were being flown in from California. The amount of gas that is being burned to get it from the local farm is a lot less than the plane from Chile or California or Florida or Argentina or whatever.
And there
China
are,
now?
Certainly, yes. And then there are counter arguments that, you know, that great masses of food flowing on one vehicle or taken on a train is actually a more efficient way of delivering calories across great distances. And the truth is, I don't know if, you know, 10 Subarus full of fresh produce is better for the – it has a smaller carbon footprint than the – you know, the giant freight train traveling across the country.
My guest is Manny Howard, whose book, My Empire of Dirt, How One Man Turned His Big City Backyard into a Farm, is published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Also on the cover, a picture of you with some rabbits and chickens and a lot of greenery with the New York skyline behind you. In other words, a cautionary tale. How seriously did you take this assignment? Was there a time when you thought this is a stupid approach, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's what I assume a radical locavore would do?
I lost all interest in the outside world and what a radical locavore would do. I became, I think, the radical locavore.
You just became consumed with your own project.
Yeah. My idea originally was to find like-minded people and trade my eggs for their cucumbers. And we'd have a beautiful, you know, community, and we would all eat well and share. And very shortly after the project started, I thought I was the only person capable of actually delivering on the promise of being able to feed myself come September. And so the rest of the world, you know, including my wife's needs and the children's, to a lesser degree the children's, but, to my, you know, faded into a routine of fix what's broken, feed what's hungry, water what's thirsty, and try to heal what's dying. And there was a fair amount of, you know, all of that.
So you weren't even paying attention to the fact that the Oxford American Dictionary added locavore to its pages in 2007, but Microsoft Spellcheck still doesn't accept the word, as I discovered today.
Is that right?
I guess Bill Gates persists on eating on a global scale.
I did discover that it had been added to the dictionary that year, but not until I sat down to write the book and thought, what just happened to me? And
so you had this timetable. Mm. That was important. You had to do this within a certain period of time.
That's right.
And that did you have any idea of just what this was going to entail, the scope of this project?
I knew it would involve a lot of work. I had absolutely no idea how much really crushing, constant, continual work it would require.
Why so much work? You plant the seeds, and then if it doesn't rain, then you bring out a hose and you water the stuff, and then everything grows.
Or so I thought. Yeah, I wanted to plant my seed. I wanted to grow all my vegetables from seeds, and I had to start in February to get them going. And I put them under grow lamps in the basement, and I placed the grow lamps too high, so they grew very fast, very tall, and then
fell over dead.
No, I'm sorry. There's a real farmers or farmers who knew what I know now know that there's a period, there's something called hardening off, which is that you keep the lights very low and then you have a fan constantly on the seeds as they grow, and that hardens the stems as they grow. But you can't have the lights too high because they spend all their energy trying to reach the light.
Mm-hmm. So then what happens? Does that mean you don't get as a bigger yield of the crop?
It means they all die and you have to start again.
Oh, so you were killing off your seeds.
Yeah, by the hundreds. It was, and then I turned to a plant nursery called Severdino on Rockaway Boulevard behind Aqueduct, which is one of the few urban plant nurseries I found that really has a wide variety of vegetables, not just your sort of tomato, basil, mm-hmm. your window box stuff. Everything from Jerusalem artichokes to eggplant. They had callaloo, which I was immediately attracted to. It's a very fine Caribbean spinach.
And were you doing squash and watermelon and all of that?
I was, yes. Beans, cucumbers.
You must have a big backyard.
Cabbage. I did potatoes. No, I have a very small backyard. I have an 800-square-foot backyard. And I'm lucky enough to have a garage. So that was the barn and abattoir.
And you said earlier that you were also using the manure from your animals. When did you decide that you were going to have animals, from the start?
Yes. I right away. It was never a question. The real question was, would I have milk, which meant would I have a goat? And I'm too easily distracted to have a goat. I decided that if...
And a goat on an 800-square-foot plot would be rather restricted, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure there are more restricted goats in the world, but you know, I intended to give him the driveway, or her, sorry, no milk from a male goat.
Are you allowed to keep a goat in the city?
No. Uh-huh. No, I knew that you could have as many chickens. Well, actually, at the time, I thought you could have up to 99 chickens. According to some old regulations.
But no roosters.
No roosters.
Because the roosters will disturb the natures, but the chickens just make soft sounds?
Yeah, that's the theory. I got some pretty hard-sounding chickens in my backyard.
They could really cluck up a storm.
Yeah, especially every morning when they lay an egg. Apparently they're surprised every time they do it.
So what experience had you had with animals before this? I mean, you had written a story about bear hunting once, hadn't you? That's not the same sort of thing.
No, you know, not at all. That was largely the experience I've had. I've done a fair amount of hunting in Montana, bird and deer. I went on an ill-fated bear hunt in the Urals, outside of Perm, a long way outside of Perm, and I boar hunted in South Carolina.
But that's hunting. This is raising animals. You want these ones to live.
Yeah, it's a very different job. It's much harder, especially the rabbits. Yeah,
you had rabbits. You had chickens. You also, for a while, were farming tilapia.
And that would have been the best strategy, I must say. If I had been able to talk the gentleman who owned the curbside tilapia farm on Butler Street into giving me some of his broodstock, I would have had. I would have had fewer problems.
But how much
protein.
Don't you need space to farm fish?
Apparently not. Apparently you need a sort of 5-foot diameter by 3-foot deep paddling pool and Buckminster Fuller's geodesic dome to keep everything at 80 degrees and some desiccated horse manure to create the algae that they feed on and very little else. Two breeding pairs would produce thousands of fish in the time that I would need, you know.
And the tilapia don't make any noise other than a little splashing once in a while.
No.
Now, but were you one of those handy people, good at home improvements? Because this is going to require a lot of building, isn't it? And an awful lot of manual labor?
Yes. I am. I grew up in a family that we helped pay for our various tuitions by renovating houses in Sunset Park that my mother and stepfather purchased in order to rent. And so we'd done. By the time we were you know, off to college, we'd been working in, on construction sites for 4 or 5 years.
So you know how to build plant boxes and things like that.
Yeah, and chicken coops and rabbit hutches, two-story rabbit hutches.
We will return to this very complicated story after we take a little break. My guest is Manny Howard, who's written a book called My Empire of Dirt, How One Man Turned His Big City Backyard into a Farm, a Cautionary Tale. It's published by Scribner. Stay with us. We're back with Manny Howard, who's written a book called My Empire of Dirt, How One Man Turned His Big City Backyard into a Farm. It's published by Scribner. You mentioned your wife. She is in the publishing business and has been successful, as you say, in holding down a job. What was her reaction to this story assignment?
I think at first when we discussed it, she was delighted that I'd found something that I was interested in after having been moping around the house and uninterested in anything. So I think I could have told her I was going to do anything as long as it had lifted my mood as this assignment had.
And you were abandoning the film project?
I had done my bit. They were still working. I was, you know, we left on good terms, but I had enough of that particular project. And I also, you know, and a lot of it's my problem. I have a very hard time working with other people.
Well, this at least you took upon yourself relatively. Well, did your kids get involved?
To the extent that I would allow it, yes. I thought it was a great idea at first, and we started digging the dry well together, and that took I didn't know how to dig a dry well, but you have to dig it through the clay till you get to sand, and then once you get to sand, you have a successful dry well. I didn't realize that sand could be anywhere from 1 foot to – well, the cliffs of Gay had, you know, flashed into my eyes, hundreds and hundreds of feet of clay before sand.
Really? In Brooklyn?
Well, I wasn't thinking clearly. It ended up being 7.5 feet straight down.
Wow.
Though, so it was,
and you didn't hit water?
No, just sand. Yeah, that would have been.
Were you ever concerned about you or your family's exposure to toxins when you were excavating the dry well and the French drains in your yard?
No, never. Probably unwisely, but that wasn't the first.
Because how much lead actually will build up in a typical backyard?
The Rutgers report, I don't remember it directly, but we went to the Rutgers Ag Extension, the neighbor and I, and it was pretty clear that you couldn't eat anything that came out of that soil. The thing is, the neighborhood was built in 1901 on top of once, you know, famously verdant farmland, mm-hmm. the breadbasket of Western Long Island, a Dutch settlement, and
this is near Prospect Park. So, Prospect Park actually preserved some of that land.
That's right,
and that's pretty good soil.
Yeah, and I was nowhere near it, or it had all been washed away in a gully. You know, the topsoil just swept away down. You know, over the years. The thing is, when the houses were built in 1901, interior space was the premium. Backyards were, you know, weren't all that interesting to anybody. And just based on the design of the neighborhood. And all those houses were painted with lead paint. Hmm. So,
and then, of course, automobiles.
Yep. And everything else that goes down Coney Island Avenue, you know. Once I had the test, I decided that I needed 9 tons of Long Island.
9 tons?
9 tons of Long Island. Well, I needed enough earth to disappear the extant surface, and that ended up being about 9 to 12 inches of dirt.
Was that your major concern starting out?
The field, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Fields of the Lord, we called it. Though it was sun-starved in most places, except for the back 40, which was the 40 square feet where the sun was almost constant.
Now, you mentioned that you started off growing things in the basement, but then later you also thought that hydroponics would help expand your gardening area and you could use your basement for that. How did that go?
I walked into the hydroponic superstore as a complete naive, thinking that they would be able to help me grow broccoli, you know, hanging from the walls. And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that I was the only person that had ever come in to the store looking for hydroponics that didn't fit in a pre-war closet. And so every request for broccoli was met with skepticism until it occurred to me that maybe they thought I was law enforcement.
Because they probably are selling to an awful lot of pot growers.
Yeah, I did everything I could to convince them that all I wanted was lots of vegetables very quickly, but that I left with a $42 self-published book about hydroponic lettuce.
So the tilapia didn't happen, the hydroponics didn't happen, and then you decided to move on to rabbits.
Right.
Now, what was the appeal of rabbits other than that they at least are supposed to reproduce very quickly?
Right. Well, that was the appeal. I mean, that's the central appeal. I thought if I could raise a lot of big rabbits, or if I could gather a lot of big rabbits, then they would have lots of big offspring very quickly, and then I would have enough meat. The rabbit meat people propaganda suggests that rabbits breed much faster, much easier, and clean up for harvest much easier than chickens.
And that didn't turn out to be true?
I think that there are some very talented meat rabbit people out there. I am not one of them. I had trouble getting them to breed, which is particularly troubling to a 40-year-old man.
There's always a problem with kids and animals. They become attached to the pig and the rabbits, and there are a lot of people won't eat rabbit simply because of Thumper.
Yes.
What happened with you? You have to kill these rabbits, don't you, when you want their meat?
Yeah, and I was very clear with the children about that, and that spurred the debate between my wife and I about whether or not we were raising children who would be aware of the source of their food and therefore better citizens, or if we were raising axe murderers. And it was a debate that raged the whole time.
Well, you beat a pregnant rabbit to death.
Yes.
That wasn't nice.
No, it was not nice. It was a horrible experience, and it came towards the end. I had given up on the rabbits as a viable meat source and had moved on to chickens, and then had recalled that chickens laid eggs and had added layer birds to the flock, which was 35 at the maximum. But the rabbits actually did get pregnant, and they actually did start to have litters, and I was well behind the curve.
It was too late.
You were behind schedule. Yeah,
uh-huh.
Right. Again, the schedule became a vaguer and vaguer notion. I wasn't preparing a magazine story. I was building a farm.
Well, couldn't you just say, I'm not going to get the story in on time, but it'll be a great story?
Yeah. Yeah, if I had any communication with New York Magazine at all, I probably would have said something like that. But I didn't think keeping them in the loop was necessary. Cause I was a farmer, not a magazine writer. Finally, I had a calling, and that's what it felt like. As crazy as it sounds, I wasn't taking notes. You know, the notes I used for the story turned out to be emails to friends in the middle of the night.
Well, that's the appeal of farming, isn't it? It is something that really can take over your life, but it can be quite fulfilling.
Yeah.
When the first tomatoes come up or whatever it is, I know tomatoes are just starting to get really big on my deck. I go by every day to check them out and make sure, oh, that one's starting to turn red. I get all excited.
Yeah. We had the first fig this morning, actually, off our fig tree, and of course it was lousy with ants. And so I was the only one that ate it. But the children loved, that we'd had the first one.
Well, you were doing this before the tomato blight hit. That was last year.
Yeah. Yes. Our tomato crop was weak. But last year's tomatoes were – I didn't have any.
Sam in New Jersey asks, how did your neighbors react to all of this?
They were – amazingly patient. I have no idea why they put up with what they
maybe,
put up with.
Maybe they all have a bit of a fantasy along similar lines.
One neighbor who I'm very fond of, Jane Fader, was my number one supporter, and she used to bring friends around the back and explain what was going on. And everybody else basically patiently put up with it. And most of them don't like eggs. They try to, you know, give them eggs, and they're not egg people.
Oh, gee.
So, you know.
Oh, I would have been thrilled to have somebody offer me fresh eggs, especially the eggs that were just laid. Fresh laid eggs taste better than any other eggs in the world.
Still warm.
a listener in Brooklyn, just so that you can feel like you're not alone, is a garden designer who just finished a garden in Clinton Hill. They tested the soil and found lead contamination at 1,000 parts per million, which is off the scale. They removed 20 yards of material from a 20 by 28 foot area.
Wow.
So what was happening? Your wife was now not as tolerant of this whole project as she was when you started.
No, her enthusiasm levels dropped as the backyard became dirtier and smellier, and I became less and less communicative about what was going on. I was in a pretty much constant state of panic, so I didn't always explain to her why there was a giant hole in the backyard or why there were now rabbits in the pen that came to be called the FEMA trailer, because whenever I brought livestock home and had not thought to build a structure for them, they went into the FEMA trailer.
Now, why didn't you build the structures first?
Not a planner.
At one point, you almost lost a finger. What happened there?
I was building a chicken coop, and I had it in my mind that I wanted it to look like the one in the Nick Parks movie, Chicken Run. And I was building the ramp, and I was cutting very small 1/8-inch plywood pieces with a table saw. And instead, I put my pinky knuckle through the table saw blade. So that slowed me down a bit. So I did have a fabulous farm aide named Caleb Townsend, who was he was on his way to university from high school in that year. Where you take classes up at Columbia, bartending classes up at Columbia, and do nothing else. And so I got him on the farm, and he became my right-hand man. He was also a lovely influence in the farm. It was lovely to have a young man who had all his biggest mistakes ahead of him. It made me feel young again.
And then people may remember there was a tornado that hit Brooklyn. Was that the year you were trying to do all of this?
Yep. August 8th.
It ripped up all the trees in the front of a friend's house.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, August 8th, 6:45, it hit. It came from a huge mass of thunderstorms in New Jersey through Staten Island, across the Narrows, destroyed a Nissan dealership in Bay Ridge, traveled through Leif Erickson Park, uprooted all those trees, and then took a left on Caton Avenue and hit our house. Or I don't think it was a direct hit, actually, and then died 500 yards in the Q train trench. So that left turn onto Caton was pretty hard not to take personally.
Well, so you understand what farmers go through when suddenly there's too much rain or there's a freeze or something else that destroys all of their hard work.
And that was the beginning of the rapprochement between Lisa and I, because she fully expected me to call it and say, cut my finger off, tornado hit, the farm, chicken coop is destroyed, you know. And I didn't. I just did what I'd been doing all along. After helping the neighbors, just started rebuilding. I froze the collard greens that were ready to go. I canned some of the tomatoes. It didn't occur to me to do anything else. And that's what really I loved so much about this project.
In the end, were you able to accomplish your goal of eating from your farm for a month?
Yes, and beyond. Although I must say that I had 30 breakfasts of 2 eggs and 1 tomato and a cup of black coffee and 30 chicken dinners with collard greens and, well, I mixed it up a bit.
But did you ever figure out how much those things were costing you? How much did an individual tomato cost or an egg or a chicken?
Probably because of a lack of math proficiency, I didn't actually do the hard work there. But I do know that I spent $11,000 building the farm, and I got 30 dinners and 30 breakfasts from it. And I'm an appreciator of good food, and I know that $11,000 over 7 months – never mind 6 weeks, would feed you pretty well. Might kill you.
You could eat a Danielle every night.
Yeah.
Every lunch and night.
And first choice, yeah.
Wendell Berry was one of the people who you thought about throughout this experience. Why?
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't think about him throughout the whole experience. I behaved like a madman.
You should have thought about Wendell Berry.
If I'd known who he was.
Really? You hadn't done any research before you started?
I was so enthusiastic and so aggressive in the sort of practicalities of getting this thing going that it wasn't until I sat down to write the book and think about what it was that had happened to me and why I was so captivated, more so, you know, imprisoned by this project, that I discovered Wendell Berry and read everything that he'd written and discovered that he'd already thought about everything that I'd done.
Well, but now you've applied all the lessons. You're still getting chickens. You're still getting vegetables. And you don't have to do all the work all the time.
That's right.
What was the reaction to the articles? Because you kind of make fun of a lot of this. Were the local farmers all amused by what you wrote for New York Magazine?
There was not universal amusement, no. A lot of people were very upset that I'd failed, which I found fascinating.
But you didn't completely fail.
No, that's right. I do that.
Mm-hmm. This is a mixed, you know, you succeeded in some areas. Obviously, you don't have the tilapia. Right. You've abandoned some of the other projects.
Yeah, you're right.
Still have the chickens.
You're right. I haven't failed. In fact, it's why I knew that I could actually commit to writing a book about it, because there's so much thinking left to do about the project and how hard it is to disconnect yourself from the transactional relationship we all have with food to one of production. And I was walking during my moonwalk when I was not eating off anything but the farm. I walked past a bodega that I visited every day. And I thought, I haven't been in there for 2 weeks, and I think it'll be four before I go back. And that feeling was one of the most profound among many.
And you're still farming. Manny Howard has written and or edited for New York Magazine, The New York Times Magazine, GQ, Esquire, Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stone, Gourmet, Food and Wine, Details, Men's Journal, Men's Health, Harper's Bazaar, Elle, Marie Claire, Cosmopolitan, U.S. Weekly, National Geographic, and Travel and Leisure, among other publications. His book, My Empire of Dirt, How One Man Turned His Big City Backyard into a Farm, is published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Leonard.